Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. Nat Turner's name rings through American history with a force all its own. As the leader of the best-known slave rebellion in the United States, Turner has been variously viewed as a freedom fighter, a murderer, an inspired religious leader, and a fanatic. Our guest this week, Kenneth Greenberg, has gathered for publication a series of essays that explores how Nat Turner has been viewed in history and why. He also served as co-producer, writer, and historian for a new documentary on Turner, A Troublesome Property. To kick off Black History Month, I'll be discussing both the book and the documentary with Professor Greenberg. Following that, Talking History's Fiona Beebe updates us on other resources on Black history we might explore. And for our commentary of the week, Richard Lubunsky looks to the past to warn us about the recent attempts by the House of Representatives to limit the Supreme Court's jurisdiction. But first, let's look at a couple of items of historical interest in the news, both in keeping with our marking of Black History Month. A silent witness to American history, the 300-year-old sycamore tree that once served as a marker for the Underground Railroad is no more. Its sprawling branches provided respite for escaped slaves. Anti-slavery activists Frederick Douglass, William Lloyd Garrison, and Wendell Phillips delivered speeches from beneath its sheltering arms. Abolitionists met there in secrecy to devise plans in their fight for equality and freedom. And women suffrage pioneers Lucy Stone and Lucretia Mott used the tree to spread their message about equal rights. But last month, city workers took chainsaws to Brockton, Massachusetts' Liberty Tree. It had been damaged over time by storms and was suffering from internal rot, arborists found, leaving the tree in a weakened and dangerous condition. City officials decided they had no choice but to cut it down, but not everyone agreed with the decision. Some onlookers expressed regret as they watched its branches fall onto the concrete beside a plaque that read, "Famous Historical Site. Under this old sycamore tree were held many meetings to help free the slaves." It's a shame that the city's leadership couldn't find a solution other than to destroy the most important object in the city, said one local resident. The tree was cut down for economic reasons, but let me tell you, if it had been the Liberty Bell instead of the Liberty Tree, things would have been different. The city plans to break ground this spring on a small park surrounding the former location of the Liberty Tree in commemoration. To help pay for the park, they are auctioning off some of the tree's branches as artifacts. And in case you're looking for a few recent bestsellers to read during Black History Month, you might look to the recently released 100 Notable Books of the Year, 2004 that is, as determined by the New York Times. That list includes Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age by Kevin Boyle, and Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson by Jeffrey C. Ward. Arc of Justice is about the 1925 murder trial of a Detroit African-American doctor who fired on a mob that had come to drive him from the house he bought in a white neighborhood. Unforgivable Blackness tells the story of the first black heavyweight champion, Jack Johnson. Happy reading. Next up, my interview with Kenneth Greenberg. After that, we'll be hearing from Fiona Beebe on our Site of the Week and Richard Lubunsky on Congress and the Supreme Court. This is Talking History. The Nat Turner Slave Rebellion occurred in Southampton County, Virginia, in August 1831. It was led by a 31-year-old man who was inspired by a series of heavenly visions to lead his people in a great battle to destroy slavery. It was a watershed event in American history, and Turner became one of the best-known figures in our history, but he remains one of the least understood. Our guest this week, Kenneth Greenberg, has tried to shed some light on this elusive figure in a new book, Nat Turner, A Slave Rebellion in History and Memory, and a new documentary on Nat Turner, subtitled A Troublesome Property, for which Greenberg served as co-producer, co-writer, and historian. Welcome, Ken.
Nice to meet you.
Good. Let's begin by just repeating the story of Nat Turner, just the facts, as they say.
Actually, the odd thing about Nat Turner, this is true for any historical story, is they really aren't just the facts, because as you pick a fact, you shape an interpretation.
Right.
But let me give you what I think are the often repeated facts connected with the story. Nat Turner lived in a remote part of Virginia, in the southern part of Virginia, in the county, Southampton County. Town of Jerusalem is where he lived nearby, and he was a Bible reader, very unusual for a slave who knew how to read, but he apparently had a great knowledge of the Bible, lived near the town of Jerusalem, and I think was inspired by that connection. As he grew up, he had a sense of his own special purpose somehow. People in the community, his family, all seemed to think he was destined for some kind of greatness. And then as the years in the 1820s and into the early 1830s, he began to have a series of visions which he felt were signs from Christ that he was supposed to pick up the mantle that Christ had once had and that he was supposed to lead a great rebellion against slavery. And so in August of 1831, he met first with a few other conspirators at a place called Cabin Pond, and then this group moved rapidly from house to house, beginning at Turner's home farm, the Joseph Travis residence, where they killed every person who they encountered, with some exceptions. They did skip some houses, but basically men, women, and children were killed, and they moved rapidly, and as they moved, they gained recruits. The rebellion probably killed in the end somewhere between close to 60 white people. The number of active rebels may have been between 60 and 80. But within a very short period of time, the entire state of Virginia and even beyond became mobilized. 3,000 militia members began to descend on the county, and they moved in, and the rebellion was basically put down very harshly within about a 24-hour period, not only with the killing of many people involved in the rebellion, many African Americans in the rebellion, but random killings of others who were suspected or just kind of a killing frenzy that occurred among the white population. We'll never quite know the numbers of blacks who were killed in the rebellion, but it far exceeded the number of whites. This is typical of slave rebellions in general. But Nat Turner himself eluded capture for 70 days after the rebellion was put down. This is an extraordinary feat. You have the most wanted man in America at that time, eluding capture, never wandering very far from his home residence. Ultimately, he was captured at the end of October and was tried very quickly. But just before his trial, a local white lawyer, not his lawyer, but a local white lawyer named Thomas R. Gray, met with him and took down what Gray says is Nat Turner's confession, and then very quickly published it. Nat Turner was hanged on November 11th, and this confession, published version, was in circulation within 2 weeks after that, basically. It's one of the great documents because it's one of the few times we have an example of getting into the mind of an American slave. Nat Turner was hanged, and then one of the most immediate reactions to this was an actual debate in the Virginia legislature, probably one of the most open, free, certainly one of the last debates that happened in the South, in which they actually discussed abolishing slavery. They discussed it because they were fearful that Nat Turner's lurked everywhere in the state of Virginia, and then they couldn't identify such a person ahead of time, and therefore it was an unsafe place. They wanted to make it safe again by both getting rid of slavery and getting rid of African Americans. They wanted to ship them out of the state, out of the country as much as possible. After the rebellion ended, after Nat Turner was hanged, after the debate occurred, and of course they didn't abolish slavery in Virginia, Nat Turner became a great symbol for blacks as a cornerstone of resistance and whites who hated slavery, and a symbol of white hatred of everything that they feared about blacks in the South.
Does that relate to why you added to your title A Slave Rebellion in History and Memory?
Absolutely. You know, the event certainly occurred in Southampton County, and then there was this legacy of Nat Turner in which the story constantly gets retold, told by many people, by historians, by poets, playwrights, novelists. There's a folk memory of it. So there are many retellings of the story, and Nat Turner, in a sense, remains vividly alive in our culture throughout its history since those events. by being part of American memory in a deep way.
Now, we can't take the time to go through all of the 13 essays as good as they are, but let's break it down by the four parts in which you divide the book and just briefly tell us what you consider to be the main points made in each one. Let's start with part one, The Search for Nat Turner.
Sure. That consists of two essays. My essay, which I think sets the tone for the whole book and asks some questions that were never asked before about Nat Turner. It asks three simple questions. What was Nat Turner's name? Nobody else has ever thought of this as a significant issue. What did he look like, and what happened to his body? Let me just give you a flavor for the problem of dealing with Nat Turner by discussing briefly the problem of his name. Everybody calls him Nat Turner, but it's not so clear of who named him and how he got that name. What happened was, during the course of the life of a slave in the South, there are no last names legally attached to a person who was enslaved. He was probably called Nat by whites. We don't know what the black community called him during the course of his childhood, for example. We don't know what his mother called him. We don't know what he called himself. There's no record of that. We know that Turner was the name of his first master, but by the time of the rebellion, he had a different master, Joseph Travis, so the fact that he ended up Nat Turner is quite interesting. Who made that decision is completely unclear. If you look at the trial records and you look at the voices of other blacks during the trial, you discover that he's never called Nat Turner by any African American. He's called Captain Nat. He's called General Nat. The place where he's really called Nat Turner is in some white newspaper accounts, and then in this Confessions of Nat Turner, which is, of course, written down by Gray, that's the place where Nat Turner's name sticks with him. African Americans in the North who came to admire him immediately said, Nat Turner isn't his name. Nat is a diminutive, the kind of thing associated with a slave. And people like Frederick Douglass, for example, always called Nat Turner Nathaniel Turner, saying that was the real name that he deserved, which was the full honorific attached with him. So you ask the question, what was his name? He had many different names, and no one knows what he called himself, actually. What he looked like, if you look at historical accounts, good historians, they consistently get this issue wrong. Because they're not looking at the one source they need to look at. There is one governor's description, a kind of a wanted poster, during the period when they're searching for Nat Turner. And in that wanted poster, basically, in words, it says, Nat Turner was light-skinned, but not a mulatto. There is no one, no historian, no novelist, no poet, until basically I stumbled across this, who actually described him as light-skinned in anything. What you'll discover is both whites and blacks refer to him repeatedly in historical memory as dark-skinned. And they had their own various reasons for doing this. Blacks wanted to have a great black hero who was black. Whites wanted to have him represent the black race and everything which was degraded, and they wanted him black as well. So, again, what he looks like is quite lost in historical memory. And then after he's executed, he's clearly dissected, and there is no grave you can go to in Southampton County to visit Nat Turner. There's no marker. There's no monument. His body is scattered, and in fact, his body pieces keep turning up throughout American history. His head, for example, people have cited his head in various locations throughout history.
Okay. Well, I want to have a few moments to deal with your documentary. So very briefly, can you pick up on a couple of points that you think are important from the rest of the book?
Sure. There's one section where I present two different stories of Nat Turner. Herbert Apthecker is one of the most interesting, probably one of the greatest historians of the 20th century because of the work he did on Nat Turner, which started his career. He wrote a master's essay at Columbia University on Turner in 1937, and he wrote about Turner as a great hero at a time when basically white racists were depicting slavery as a benevolent institution and Nat Turner as a fanatic and crazy man. And he actually went back to the sources and presented lots of the evidence which historians still use today. In the same section, Thomas Paramore is another historian who's recently deceased, as is Apthecker, by the way. And he describes Nat Turner as a mystic, as not a revolutionary leader, as unable to lead a military effort of any sort, as not preventing his men from drinking, as wandering aimlessly through the countryside killing white people, a radically different image of Nat Turner.
Right. Okay, well, let's turn to your documentary because you only have a couple minutes left, and let me ask you a couple questions on that. First of all, why did you subtitle it A Troublesome Property?
Given everything I've said, what we're really talking about in reference to A Troublesome Property is that obviously Nat Turner was regarded as property by the white people who owned him, but then after he dies, and even before he dies, he becomes the property of those who try to capture his image. He becomes the property of the newspapers who write about him. He becomes the property of Thomas Gray, who tries to create a particular image of Nat Turner. And he becomes the property of every historian, poet, playwright, novelist after him as well. And what the movie tries to do is to tell the story of how no single image of Nat Turner emerges in our culture. Just as his body is cut up into pieces, his image remains cut up into pieces as a kind of reflection of racial division in our society.
And you do that by dramatizing scenes differently, different versions of the story, and interspersing documentary footage and interviews. It's an interesting approach.
It's actually almost unique. And in a way, one way to think about the film is to think of it as an anti-Ken Burns approach to history. Rather than presenting a single story, we present multiple stories, showing, first of all, the real complexity that historians deal with and that American memory deals with. And by having historians and others comment on the recreated versions, we constantly undercut what viewers see before them. So in the end, someone looking at the film will not have a particularly clear image of the real Nat Turner. They will have a set of images which tells you a lot about our society and about race relations in our society as people look at Nat Turner in radically different ways.
Could you have approached this from the perspective of Ken Burns? Could it have been told in a more linear fashion, or in this particular case with Turner, was it just out of the question?
No, actually, I've been working on this. The amount of historical research necessary to reconstruct a real Nat Turner is beyond belief. No one has ever come close to it. After all, think of that one question I asked, which is the question of what his name was. Now, I spent 20 pages this pointing out how problematic his name was, and in the end, we didn't know his name. So it's that kind of painstaking research. There are incredible sources connected to the trial records, to newspaper accounts. They need to be used very, very carefully, and no one's really done that. So in a sense, it would be impossible to do that on film until someone did it in writing, and I'm in the middle of doing that study now.
Well, that'll be interesting. Okay, a minute left. Quickly, let's comment on something that is usually associated with this whole story, which is the William Styron's novel back in 1967, The Confessions of Nat Turner. You spend a lot of time in the book on this, but very briefly, what's the issue here with that particular book?
Styron won the Pulitzer Prize for a novel about Nat Turner, and in his literary imagination, he created a Nat Turner who lusted after a white woman as one of the hearts of what motivated Nat Turner. And black critics of the 60s looked at that, looked at many other things as well, and said this was a white fantasy. So this book, which won the Pulitzer Prize, which then established Nat Turner's image in American culture, black critics immediately, and many whites as well, said this is a racist vision of Nat Turner. And actually, both in the book and in the film, what we try to show is a kind of a clash of worldviews, that Styron has a particular angle, a way of looking at things, and the black critics had a particular angle as well. That is not just a historical debates which you can settle through looking at the facts of the case.
Well, I hadn't thought of it from the perspective you just brought up, but I think the real value of the video, in a way, is it picks up on the book by presenting many different images, and it doesn't just try to define one clear line when it comes to Nat Turner. So I think this is the real contribution to anyone who's really interested in the complexities of history.
I think that that's right. Usually there's a great temptation in film to simplify the storyline, and that's a mistake. It's not what historians do in their writing typically. Many do, but many don't. They point out the difficulty of knowing the truth of the past.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you for joining us. I wish we had more time to talk about it, but it's a great book and documentary.
Thank you very much.
Our guest this week has been Kenneth Greenberg, editor of Nat Turner, A Slave Rebellion in History and Memory, published by Oxford University Press, and co-producer, co-writer, and historian for the new documentary, Nat Turner, A Troublesome Property, available from California Newsreel. This is Talking History. Talking History's Fiona Beattie is back, this week picking up on our tribute to Black History Month and our discussion of Nat Turner, as well as our passing reference to Frederick Douglass.
Such was the impact of the insurrection in Southampton that it is said in days of old misbehaving white children were threatened with a visit from the ghost of Nat Turner. The published confessions of Nat Turner were an attempt to set the record straight, promote vigilance, and show a fearful public that the participants had been dealt with. Its immediate legacy can be summed up in one sentence from the text. It will be long remembered in the annals of our country, and many a mother, as she presses her infant darling to her bosom, will shudder at the recollection of Nat Turner and his band of ferocious miscreants. Today, the confessions, along with the document of the trial, lists of victims, and the punishments meted out to the insurrection's perpetrators are available online as part of the University of North Carolina's Documenting the American South collection. To find out more, go to www.docsouth.unc.edu. And if you have an appetite for more online research on Black history, the Frederick Douglass papers are now available online at the Library of Congress. The extensive collection contains over 7,000 papers, including diaries, family papers, correspondence, and legal files. To explore the collection, go to www.loc.gov, keyword Frederick Douglass.
Our guest commentator this week, Richard Lubunsky, views with some concern, based on history, the House of Representatives' recent attempt to forbid the U.S. Supreme Court from considering any Pledge of Allegiance cases. Interestingly, Congress may have the constitutional authority to do it, but Lubunsky warns us of the dangers that can flow from such action. Lubunsky is a professor of journalism at the University of Kentucky and the author of The Second Constitutional Convention.
A few months ago, the U.S. House of Representatives did something extraordinary. By an overwhelming margin, it voted to take away from the Supreme Court the case involving the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance, words that a lower court said must be removed. It may come as a surprise to most people, but the Constitution gives Congress the right to take such action. Those who wrote the Constitution knew they were creating a potentially powerful federal judiciary, with judges who serve for life and who make decisions that affect us in profound ways. To keep federal judges from becoming both oppressive and unaccountable, a dangerous combination, the framers gave Congress the authority to remove cases from the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction, which is how the court gets almost all its cases. That means Congress could stop federal judges from hearing cases dealing with abortion, affirmative action, the death penalty, and many other issues. Throughout our history, Congress has exercised this awesome power on very few occasions. It did so after the Civil War to prevent the Supreme Court from deciding a case that Congress feared could be used to declare the entire Reconstruction program to be unconstitutional. During the anti-communist Red Scare of the 1950s, Congress came within one vote of removing cases involving those accused of disloyalty. Congress has never considered such a drastic action on so trivial a matter as whether "under God" should be in the Pledge of Allegiance. Apparently, the House did not want to take the chance that the court may strike those words, so by a 74-vote margin, it decided to remove the case from all federal judges. By its action, the House has shown an appalling lack of appreciation for the role of an independent federal court system. We have all been angered and disappointed by the way judges decide some of the most contentious issues of our time. But it is one thing to criticize the outcome of a case and hope that it will be modified later on. It is something else for Congress to remove the case completely because it may not like the way judges will decide it. The pledge controversy comes at a time in the nation's history when fear of terrorism has tested our commitment to preserving the Bill of Rights. Congress could take advantage of that anxiety and stop the federal courts from hearing cases involving the rights of terrorism suspects and those who protest government policies. We rely on federal judges to protect individual rights, especially when the persons involved promote controversial ideas or are considered a threat to the nation's security. The judicial branch cannot perform that indispensable function if Congress removes the power to decide such cases. Although the Constitution gives Congress that authority, it should know better than to use it.
You've been listening to Richard Lubunsky, professor of journalism at the University of Kentucky and the author of The Second Constitutional Convention. Lubunsky's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the program and even been moved to further explore the history of African Americans. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beatty, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.